Today's session, again, you should be here for Management Standards for Hazardous Waste Pharmaceuticals, an amendment to the hazardous waste listing for nicotine. I'm going to go ahead and call up the presentation materials and turn things over to the first speaker, again, Kristen Fitzgerald from EPA's Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. Kristen, please feel free to begin.
Okay, great. Thank you, Jean. And welcome, everybody, and we're glad you could join us today for our fourth and final public webinar on the rule. So I'm Kristen Fitzgerald, and I'm going to start us off today, but you will also hear from my colleagues, Brian Kneiser and Laura Stanley. So we've done this several times now, so we know we're running a little over an hour, like about 70 minutes typically, and then that will be followed by a Q&A session. So despite the fact that it will run about 70 minutes, this stage we really only have time to cover the final rule at an introductory level. It will assume that you have a working knowledge of RCRA and the current RCRA regulations. There's not a lot of detail in many areas that we're going to be covering. It's very kind of conceptual, big picture in many cases. But not to worry, in the coming months we will do longer format trainings that will take a deeper dive into various issues. Here's an outline for today's presentation. The bulk of the presentation today will be spent going over the individual provisions of Subpart P in the order that they appear in the regulations. So the final rule was signed by the administrator of EPA back in December of 2018, and we posted an unofficial pre-publication version on our website, but it wasn't published officially kind of in the Federal Register until February 22nd. That's because of the shutdown was in between those two events. The FR publication, other than being the official date for the release of the rule, is also important because it drives both the effective dates of the rule as well as the state adoption deadlines. So some states are actually already in the process of adopting this final rule, and I just wanted to make them aware, for those that are listening, that the Office of Federal Register did make some small tweaks to the numberings and headings in the regulatory language. So the FR version is the regs in the FR version are slightly different than the pre-publication version. So just be aware of that, and if you have any questions, you can contact me about that. Okay, so before we kind of get into the meat of the discussing the final rule, just want to kind of look at things at the big picture level first. So I think of the pharmaceuticals rule as three rules in one. The first being Part 266, Subpart P, and we usually just say Subpart P. The second being the reverse logistics policy, and the third being amendment to the nicotine listing in Part 261. So under Subpart P, there are several things that we are trying to do with Subpart P. One is to create regulations that are a better fit for the healthcare sector for the management of hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. Instead of applying kind of the standard Part 262 hazardous waste generator regulations that they're subject to now, wanted to try and get a better fit for them with some new regulations. Second, we were trying to eliminate the intentional sewering of hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. Third, we're reducing to the extent we could overlapping regulations with DEA and FDA. And fourth, is part of Subpart P as well as the reverse logistics policy. We're providing regulatory clarity and national consistency on how RCRA applies to both reverse distribution and reverse logistics. The reverse logistics policy is something we committed to in the 2016 retail strategy. So we'll get into the distinction between reverse distribution and reverse logistics a little bit later, but we're dealing with both pharmaceuticals as well as non-pharmaceuticals. So in pharmaceuticals, that appears in Subpart P, and for non-pharmaceuticals, that's part of the reverse logistics policy in the preamble. And then finally, in Part 261, we are reevaluating whether nicotine replacement therapy should be regulated as hazardous waste, as acute hazardous waste, excuse me, and if possible, provide some regulatory relief by amending the PO75 listing in Part 261 so that not every corner pharmacy is an LPG. So that would provide relief both to the regulated community and to the states. So let's focus on subpart P part of that, still kind of at the big picture, though, right? So the bulk of what we're going to be talking about today is subpart P. So subpart P is both a waste-specific and a sector-specific final rule. It's for the management of hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. So that's the waste-specific part, and it's only applicable at healthcare facilities and reverse distributors. So that's the sector-specific part of the rule. So whether or not people are aware of this or realize it, these hazardous wastes and this sector are already regulated under RCRA, and they have been since the beginning of RCRA in 1980. So we're not newly applying the RCRA regulations to hazardous waste pharmaceuticals at healthcare facilities and reverse distributors. Just want to make that clear. This is not newly applying RCRA to these folks. We're changing how they're regulated under RCRA moving forward. I'm going to hand it over to Brian Kneiser at this point, and he's going to walk through effective dates and state adoption.
All right, thanks, Kristen. We wanted to do this, talk about the effective dates and state adoption before we really get into the details of the rule. I know at this point you might not be familiar with all parts of the rule, but we wanted to do it up front so that you're at least aware of the temporal component as we go along. So this rule goes into effect federally on August 21st of this year, and there are three different parts of the rule that have different effective dates and adoption requirements, and those are the nicotine amendment, subpart P, and the sewer prohibition. So the effective dates and state adoption requirements are going to differ depending on whether or not a state is authorized or if it's non-authorized, and really there are only two non-authorized states, which are Iowa and Alaska, and what that means is that they don't have an approved hazardous waste program, and so EPA is the agency that implements the regulations in those states. And so all parts of the rule will go into effect in those non-authorized states on August 21st. So starting with the nicotine amendment, again, it will be effective federally on August 21st of this year. Our rules go into effect 6 months after they've been published in the Federal Register, and so that means that the nicotine amendment will be in effect in non-authorized states, Indian country, and U.S. territories other than Guam on the 21st of August. The nicotine amendment, it modifies the listing in Part 261, and so that means that it actually applies to all generators, not just healthcare facilities and reverse distributors. So in states that are authorized, the nicotine amendment will only be in effect if and when that state chooses to adopt it. This part of the rule is considered to be less stringent than the previous regulations, so that means that authorized states are not required to adopt it, and there are no corresponding adoption deadlines. But we do expect, however, that most states will eventually end up adopting the nicotine amendment. So moving on to subpart P, again, it's going to be in effect federally on August 21st of this year in Iowa and Alaska, Indian Country, and U.S. territories. So in authorized states, the state first has to adopt it before subpart P will go into effect, but subpart P is actually considered to be more stringent than the previous regulations, so that means that eventually all states in Guam will have to adopt it, which will provide increased national consistency, which was one of the big requests from commenters during the proposed rule. So because the rule was already published in the Federal Register, the adoption clock is already ticking, and authorized states have until July 1st of 2021 to adopt subpart P unless they require a statutory amendment to adopt new rules, in which case they get an extra year. We do actually expect, however, that many states will adopt sooner than that, particularly Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and I believe Virginia and Washington have also indicated that they'll be in that first wave of adopters. So the sewer prohibition is a little different because it's being promulgated under HISWA authority, and that matters because HISWA regs go into effect in all states 6 months after publication in the Federal Register, regardless of whether or not the state is authorized. So that means that the sewer prohibition will go into effect in all states on August 21st, whether or not the state is authorized or has or hasn't adopted subpart P. It also applies to all healthcare facilities and reverse distributors, regardless of their generator category. So again, The sewer prohibition applies to all healthcare facilities and reverse distributors, and that's going to start on August 21st. So this is just a visual representation of what I just went through. I'm not going to spend any time on it, but you can, it's there for your reference. All right, moving on to the rule itself, starting with the amendment to the nicotine listing. Again, this this part of the rule is separate from subpart P in that it amends part 261 as opposed to part 266, which is where subpart P is. So that means that it applies to all generators. So you may or may not be aware, but nicotine is considered an acute hazardous waste when it's discarded with the waste code PO75, and it's been that way since 1980. What the amendment does is it modifies that PO75 listing so that FDA-approved over-the-counter nicotine replacement therapies will no longer be included in the PO75 listing. So why did we do that? During the rulemaking process, we considered comments, we conducted literature reviews, and we ultimately concluded that nicotine patches, gums, and lozenges don't meet the regulatory criteria for acute hazardous waste. So nicotine patches, gums, and lozenges, just those three types of items, can now be discarded as non-hazardous waste. Some commenters expressed concern about people dumpster diving for these things, and so we also included some recommended best practices in the preamble to prevent illicit diversion. And just to back up for a minute, we're now calling these things FDA-approved OTC NRTs. And so we took a really long phrase and made it into a long acronym. But you're going to hear that again a lot, probably. So I just wanted to make sure that you understand that when we say OTC NRTs, we mean FDA-approved over-the-counter nicotine replacement therapies. So even though we removed FDA-approved OTC NRTs from the PO75 listing, nicotine is still considered an acute hazardous waste when it's discarded. So that means that other unused formulations of nicotine will still be considered PO75 when they're discarded. And some examples include e-cigarette juices, cartridges, and vials. Those will likely fall under the definition of pharmaceutical, which Laura is going to get into in more detail. Also, prescription drugs. Prescription nicotine drugs will also be PO75. And anything in those two bullets are likely to be considered pharmaceuticals, which means that they can be managed under subpart B. Some examples of things that can't be managed under subpart P are legacy nicotine pesticides, nicotine that's used in research and manufacturing. Those are not pharmaceuticals. They wouldn't meet the definition of pharmaceutical, and so that means that they have to be managed under part 262. So I will now hand it over to Laura to talk about reverse distribution and reverse logistics.
All right. So as Kristen mentioned, one of the goals of this final rule is to provide regulatory clarity surrounding reverse distribution and reverse logistics. For the final rule, we've adopted the terminology suggested to us by commenters and distinguished between reverse distribution and reverse logistics. Under the final rule, reverse distribution refers to the process where prescription pharmaceuticals are sent to a reverse distributor where they are evaluated to see if they get manufacturer's credit. On the other hand, reverse logistics refers to the process where non-prescription pharmaceuticals and other unsold retail items are sent to a reverse logistics center where they are evaluated to see if they will be used, reused, or reclaimed. Commenters in the proposal noted that there's a difference in the reverse flow process for prescription pharmaceuticals and non-prescription pharmaceuticals and other retail items. Non-prescription pharmaceuticals and other unsold retail items are sent to reverse logistics centers where they are evaluated to see if they can be reused, so liquidated, donated, sold on the secondary market, or sent for reclamation. In this rule, we finalize that non-prescription pharmaceuticals and other unsold retail items will not be considered waste at the healthcare or retail facility if they have a reasonable expectation of being reused or reclaimed. And this is a visual representation of that reverse flow process for non-prescription pharmaceuticals and other unsold retail items. So if there's a reasonable expectation that they'll be donated, sold, recycled, repaired, reclaimed, They can be sent from the healthcare facility to the reverse logistics center, where they're evaluated to see if they can go for one of those reasons. If they decide the items cannot actually be used, reused, or reclaimed for some reason, they need to be properly disposed of by hazardous waste by the reverse logistics center. On the other hand, if at the healthcare facility, the non-prescription pharmaceuticals and other unsold retail items have no reasonable expectation of use, reuse, or reclamation, they need to be disposed of as hazardous waste by the healthcare facility. For reverse logistics, this policy is really status quo. You see similar language in the preamble to the final rule as you do in the 1991 memo that has formed our longstanding policy. This is no mistake. As I've already described, non-prescription pharmaceuticals and other unsold retail items are regularly sent to reverse logistics centers where they're evaluated to see if they can be reused or reclaimed. And this is why they can be sent from the retail stores and healthcare facilities to reverse logistics centers and not be considered waste until the reverse logistics center makes the decision to discard. On the other hand, commenters in the proposed rule confirm that prescription pharmaceuticals that are sent to reverse distributors, where they are evaluated to see if they will get manufacturer's credit, are not reused, reclaimed, or resold. Rather, they are all discarded. Reverse distributors receive the prescription pharmaceuticals from healthcare facilities and facilitate the process of crediting healthcare facilities for these unused pharmaceuticals. However, they are not liquidated, donated, or sent for reclamation. They are all discarded by the reverse distributor. Thus, this final rule maintains the position that we put forth in the proposed rule, which is that prescription pharmaceuticals moving through reverse distribution are waste at the healthcare facility. The fact that these hazardous waste pharmaceuticals do have value in the form of manufacturer's credit has allowed us to take a tailored and more flexible regulatory approach to managing these hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. And closer to the end of the presentation, I'll talk more about the standards for reverse distributors. And this is just a visual representation of the reverse flow process for prescription pharmaceuticals. A healthcare facility can send potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals to a reverse distributor if they have a reasonable expectation of receiving credit from the manufacturer. The healthcare facility and reverse distributors have to manage these potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals under the new subpart P standards in this final rule. The reverse distributor then evaluates the pharmaceuticals, and if they need to be sent to another reverse distributor for further evaluation, they are still considered potentially creditable. Otherwise, they become evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, and the reverse distributor must ultimately send them for hazardous waste disposal. On the other hand, if the healthcare facility generates a prescription hazardous waste pharmaceutical that has no reasonable expectation of receiving credit from the manufacturer, these are considered non-creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, and they must be sent straight for hazardous waste disposal. And I'll elaborate more on potentially creditable versus non-creditable in a few minutes. All right, so we really just want to hammer home the point that in this final rule, we are recognizing a key distinction in the industry between reverse distribution and reverse logistics. Note that these distinct processes already existed prior to the rule, and commenters told us about them. And we built this final regulatory structure around these distinct processes. We were not creating them anew. So we codified the policy on reverse distribution in subpart P, which means it won't be effective in non-authorized states until 6 months after publication. And for authorized states, it becomes effective when the state adopts subpart P. And again, reverse logistics refers to the process where non-prescription pharmaceuticals and other unsold retail items are sent to reverse logistics centers where they're evaluated to see if they can be reused, used, or reclaimed. In this final rule, we finalize that non-prescription pharmaceuticals and other unsold retail items will not be considered waste at the healthcare facility if they have a reasonable expectation of being used, reused, or reclaimed. So we codified this in subpart P, but this policy affirms our existing policy and thus is effective immediately at the federal level. However, states have taken a variety of positions on reverse logistics, so please check with your state to confirm their policy on reverse logistics. All right, so we are going to move on to subpart P, the regulations for the management of hazardous waste pharmaceuticals by healthcare facilities and reverse distributors. We defined many new terms under subpart P. This is a list of all the terms defined in the final rule, and I'm going to walk through a few of them. In particular, the definitions of pharmaceutical and healthcare facility determine who is allowed to operate under subpart P and what those folks are allowed to manage under subpart P. First, we derived the definition of pharmaceutical from FDA's definition of drug, but we went further than FDA. Included things we might not traditionally think of as a pharmaceutical, like dietary supplements and personal protective equipment contaminated with pharmaceuticals. These are included because we want healthcare facilities to be able to manage a lot of their common hazardous waste streams under the same standards. Brian walked us through the exemption for FDA-approved OTC NRTs and pointed out that electronic cigarettes and vaping pens are not part of that exception. However, they are included in the final definition of pharmaceutical so that healthcare facilities can have the benefits of managing them under subpart P. So note that for liquid nicotine, this only includes the pre-filled cartridges that are packaged for retail and does not include bulk liquid nicotine that a vaping store might use to mix its own e-liquid. And on the right-hand side on the bottom, you can see the things that are not included in the definition of pharmaceutical. We explicitly exclude dental amalgam, for example, because there's another EPA rule on the Office of Water that specifically addresses dental amalgam. A hazardous waste pharmaceutical is a pharmaceutical that is a solid waste and exhibits one or more characteristics or is listed. And as I pointed out earlier, a non-prescription pharmaceutical is not a solid waste and thus not a hazardous waste pharmaceutical if it has a reasonable expectation of being legitimately used, reused, or reclaimed as being sent to a reverse logistics center. There are three types of hazardous waste pharmaceuticals that are defined under subpart P. First, non-credible hazardous waste pharmaceuticals are the hazardous waste pharmaceuticals that have no expectation of receiving manufacturer's credit. For example, cleanup material from the spills of hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, contaminated PPE, these are all things, these are all hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. They clearly have no possibility of getting manufacturer's credit. And on the slide, you can see a more comprehensive list of examples. Non-credible hazardous waste pharmaceuticals must be sent straight for hazardous waste disposal and cannot be sent to a reverse distributor. Second, a potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceutical is a prescription hazardous waste pharmaceutical that has a reasonable expectation of receiving manufacturer's credit, and these can be sent to a reverse distributor for evaluation. These have to have a reasonable expectation of receiving credit, and they have to meet three criteria. They have to be in original manufacturer's packaging, unless they're recalls. They must be undispensed, and they must be unexpired or less than 1 year past expiration. It's important to know that healthcare facilities do not need to know when hazardous waste pharmaceuticals are going to end up actually getting credit. The reverse distributor is the one who knows the credit policies of the manufacturer and can determine which pharmaceuticals get credit. They simply have to have a reasonable expectation of receiving credit. So the non-credible hazardous waste pharmaceuticals are the ones that the healthcare facility really knows is not going to get credit for whatever reason. So cleanup material from the spills of hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, they clearly can't get credit from a reverse distributor. So they would be a non-credible hazardous waste pharmaceutical. And the third type is the evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceutical. So So after the reverse distributor receives the potentially credible hazardous waste pharmaceuticals and evaluates them and determines if credit should be issued, they become evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, and they need to be managed as evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceuticals under Subpart B and ultimately sent for hazardous waste disposal. If the reverse distributor decides they need to be sent to another reverse distributor for further evaluation of manufacturer's credit, they can send them as potentially credible hazardous waste pharmaceuticals to the next reverse distributor. Under the final rule, the definition of healthcare facility includes things we traditionally think of as a healthcare facility. So hospitals, dentists, doctor's offices, but it also includes things that we might not traditionally think of as a healthcare facility, like a pharmacy, for example. And this is because we want them to be able to manage their hazardous waste pharmaceuticals under Subpart P. We also included wholesale distributors in the final definition, because we want to ensure they can continue sending potentially credible hazardous waste pharmaceuticals to reverse distributors. However, the healthcare facility definition does not include pharmaceutical manufacturers, reverse distributors, or reverse logistics centers. The definition of healthcare facility also includes long-term care facilities. Long-term care facilities includes nursing homes and hospice facilities, but it does not include assisted living facilities or independent living communities. Originally in the proposed rule, we included assisted living facilities in the definition of long-term care facility, but we did not include them in the final definition in order to be more consistent with the definitions that DEA uses and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services uses. I talked about the functions of a reverse distributor already, but getting to the definition now, the final rule defines a reverse distributor as a person who receives prescription pharmaceuticals for the purpose of facilitating or verifying manufacturer credit. This can include forward distributors and manufacturers. If they're processing prescription pharmaceuticals to verify them for credit, they are considered a reverse distributor under the rule. Our definition of reverse distributor differs from DEA's definition of reverse distributor. Under DEA regulations, reverse distributors register with DEA and take control of controlled substances for disposal or to send to a manufacturer. Under DEA's definition, a reverse distributor does not necessarily need to process pharmaceuticals for the purpose of determining manufacturer's credit. Really, their main function under the DEA definition is to destroy the controlled substances. Under EPA's definition, a reverse distributor is defined as a facility that accepts potentially credible pharmaceuticals for the purpose of evaluating manufacturer's credit. So that covers the main terms defined under the rule, and I'm going to hand it back to Kristen to talk about applicability under the final rule.
Okay, thanks, Laura. So as we move forward and discuss the remaining slides, right, because now we're just about to finally get into the meat of things. We've kind of set things up with the definitions, and now we're going to get into the meat of things of Subpart P. Our job here is to fill in this chart with provisions of Subpart P. It's a very conceptual, high level, just some highlights of the rule to give you the broad outlines of the rule. But I think you can see just even with the headers here, without any of the content, you can see that the regulations depend on two things. First, it depends on the type of facility, right? One column is standards for healthcare facilities, and the other column is for standards for reverse distributors. So it depends upon the type of facility you are, but also depends upon the type of hazardous waste pharmaceutical that you are managing. So there's the three types that Laura just mentioned. It depends on whether it's potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceutical, non-creditable, or a evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceutical. So as Brian mentioned earlier, on the whole, Part 266 of Part P is considered more stringent than the existing regulations, and therefore it's not optional. It's not optional for the states to adopt it, and is also not optional for the healthcare facilities and reverse distributors. So hazardous waste pharmaceuticals must be managed under Subpart P by all healthcare facilities and all reverse distributors. There's one very big if, though, about healthcare facilities. So a healthcare facility that generates above VSQG amounts of hazardous waste is subject to Subpart P. Okay, so that turns out to be a really big if, because we estimate that about 80% of healthcare facilities actually generate small enough amounts of hazardous waste to be VSQGs and therefore not subject to Subpart P, except the sewer prohibition, which we'll talk about later, right? So all healthcare facilities that generate above VSQG amounts of hazardous waste, and then all reverse distributors must manage their hazardous waste pharmaceuticals under Subpart P. Right, so Subpart P, as I mentioned earlier, is both a waste-specific and a sector-specific rulemaking. That means that Subpart P only applies when healthcare facilities and reverse distributors manage hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. And both of those criteria must be met for Subpart P to apply. Right, so if you see that first row about healthcare facilities and reverse distributors, if they're managing hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, Subpart P applies. But if they're managing other hazardous waste, then Subpart P does not apply. Now, they're still hazardous waste, they're still subject to RCRA, but they're subject to other parts of RCRA. Likewise, if you look through the second row of the slide, you see other facilities that aren't healthcare facilities and reverse distributors. Subpart P will not apply, even when managing hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. So, like I said, they're generating hazardous waste. Those hazardous waste are subject to RCRA, just not this new part. It's waste-specific and sector-specific. So once a facility is subject to Part 266, Subpart P, there are no generator categories under Subpart P. The generator categories that we're all familiar with, SQG and LQG, those are under Part 262. All healthcare facilities are regulated the same for managing their hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, and all reverse distributors are regulated the same for managing their hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. Now, the good news about that setup is that healthcare facilities and reverse distributors operating under Subpart P, they no longer have to keep track of how much hazardous waste pharmaceuticals they generate per month, and they don't have to segregate the acute and the non-acute hazardous waste pharmaceuticals to help them, you know, calculate how much they're generating per month. So the idea behind this is that we're hopeful that this will provide an incentive for healthcare facilities to overmanage their non-hazardous waste pharmaceuticals as hazardous without having to worry about bumping up and generate a category and incurring additional regulations, a phenomenon we call episodic generation. Right, so as a healthcare facility, once you're operating under Subpart P, the regs are going to remain the same no matter how much hazardous waste pharmaceuticals you generate. So new in the final rule, sorry, the slide looks a little different than I was expecting. So new in the final rule is we added for a list of pharmaceuticals that are not subject to RCRA regulation. We added this for clarity since the proposed rule and also to address some changes that we made since the proposed rule based on comments. So the first couple of ones we've already talked about, and because they were already included in the definition of hazardous waste pharmaceutical, but we, just to be super clear, we also addressed them in the applicability of the rule. So pharmaceuticals are not solid waste because they're legitimately used, reused, or reclaimed, aren't subject to RCRA regulation or Subpart P. And we added this to accommodate donations, which are rare for reasons that have nothing to do with RCRA, but we hope, you know, will increase, and we didn't want to be the one standing in the way of that increasing in the future. The second one is OTC pharmaceuticals and other non-prescription pharmaceuticals if they have a reasonable expectation of being legitimately used or reused or reclaimed. Laura's already discussed that. So let's focus on the next three. Recall pharmaceuticals under preservation order, and investigational new drugs. Also not subject to RCRA, at least initially. There's a little asterisk there that leads us down to the bottom of the page. So in the case of all three of these, we are deferring to other regulatory agencies, primarily FDA, at least initially, to avoid duplicative or perhaps even contradictory regulations. So RCRA will apply, however, when the other agencies leave off. So when those hazardous waste pharmaceuticals are discarded, then RCRA will apply, and since they're hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, Subpart P will apply for all of those. And then finally, number six, the household waste pharmaceuticals. We want to make clear that everybody realize that household disposal of hazardous waste is still exempt federally. Not all states follow that. But as with the DEA regulations, when collected, the healthcare facilities that are DEA registrants and collectors of household pharmaceuticals must comply with certain new conditions that are in 266-506 and specify methods of treatment instruction. And we'll talk more about that later. So as long as it's discarded by the household, it's still exempt. But when collected, then they're also still largely exempt, but there are a few conditions that will attach to them. So for the visual learners among us, we've diagrammed out the applicability of for the rule for both prescription and non-prescription pharmaceuticals as they move through, you know, from healthcare facility to reverse distributor, reverse logistics center, and hazardous waste treatment storage and disposal facilities. So let's talk about the prescription pharmaceuticals first. So here are the three types of hazardous waste pharmaceuticals that Laura discussed just a few minutes ago, right? The non-creditable, the potentially creditable, and the evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. So for prescription pharmaceuticals, in all cases, Subpart P will apply to the management of those, when they're non-creditable, when they're potentially creditable, when they're evaluated. Reverse distributors, for them, their hazardous waste consists almost exclusively of pharmaceuticals. So Subpart P is the more appropriate regulatory scheme for them. Okay. So with non-prescription pharmaceuticals, it's a very different situation. Although with for the non-creditable, non-prescription, it is similar to prescription in that they will we will newly be applying Subpart P. So this will allow healthcare facilities to manage all their hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, both prescription and non-prescription, the same when they're destined directly from the healthcare facility to a TSDF. So non-creditable is the one type of hazardous waste pharmaceutical that includes both prescription and non-prescription pharmaceuticals. But otherwise, non-prescription pharmaceuticals are not subject to Subpart P. So, you know, the stuff that's destined for reverse logistics center because there's a reasonable expectation of use, reuse, or reclamation, that's status quo. Subpart P is not going to apply. They wouldn't be considered a solid waste. And likewise, the stuff going from reverse logistics center to a TSDF, also Subpart P will not apply, will continue to be, these are wastes, and they will continue to be regulated under Part 262 of the regulations, the current RCRA hazardous waste generator regulations. So unlike reverse distributors, reverse logistics centers have lots of different types of hazardous waste besides hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. So we thought that applying 262 is more appropriate in this case as opposed to 266 of Part P. Okay, so I'm going to hand it back to Brian, and he'll discuss the healthcare facility standards.
Thanks, Kristen. So I'm going to start by talking about some of the administrative requirements for healthcare facilities. To begin with, all healthcare facilities that are subject to Subpart P have to submit a one-time notification that they're operating under Subpart P, and they can do that using the set ID form 8712. And I just want to reassure everyone that we've been and continue to work with our data and reporting colleagues to make sure that the changes to the set ID form that are required by the rule will be implemented in time for the federal effective date. So there are two time frames within which a healthcare facility has to notify, and they're going to depend on whether or not that facility is required to submit the biennial report. Facilities that are not required to submit BR will have to notify within 60 days of the rule going into effect in their state. So for non-authorized states, notifications will be due on the 20th of October of this year. Facilities that do have to submit to BR can report on their normal, or they can notify on their normal biennial reporting cycle. So in non-authorized states, notifications will be due with March 1st, 2020 BR. And you might be wondering why we don't just say LQGs can notify on their normal BR reporting cycle, and that's because in some states, SQGs are also required to submit BR. So if you're in a state where you're an SQG and you have to submit the BR, you can also report on your normal reporting cycle. The training standards that we finalized are performance-based, which means that they're non-prescriptive, and they basically say that all healthcare personnel that manages hazardous waste pharmaceuticals have to be thoroughly familiar with the proper waste handling and emergency procedures for the waste that they generate, which is basically similar to the 262 SQG training standards and small quantity universal waste handler training standards. So the next two slides highlight some of the management standards for pharmaceutical waste at healthcare facilities. So one of the fundamental aspects of subpart P is that the healthcare facility has to make hazardous waste determinations for all of the waste pharmaceuticals that they generate. So that means that healthcare facilities have to determine whether each pharmaceutical waste is hazardous, and that applies to both potentially creditable and non-creditable waste pharmaceuticals. However, one of the big flexibilities that we built into the rule is to allow healthcare facilities to manage all of their waste pharmaceuticals as hazardous, and if they choose to do that, then individual waste determinations are not going to be necessary because they'll be essentially making one blanket hazardous waste determination for all of their waste pharmaceuticals. One reason we did that is because it eases compliance burden for healthcare facilities, but like Kristen mentioned, it also, we're trying to incentivize healthcare facilities to manage all of their pharmaceutical waste as hazardous, which will keep them out of landfills, and we believe that will reduce the amount of pharmaceuticals that are entering waterways as landfill leachate. So to go along with that flexibility, we're allowing healthcare facilities to commingle their pharmaceutical waste. So that means healthcare facilities may accumulate both their hazardous and non-hazardous waste pharmaceuticals in the same container. And that's true for potentially creditable and non-creditable waste pharmaceuticals. So I'm going to talk quickly about the container and labeling standards. Containers that are used to accumulate non-creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals have to be labeled with the words hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, but we're not requiring any other information on the label. It's allowed but not required. The containers themselves have to be structurally sound, and the healthcare facilities have to ensure that the contents won't react with the contents. That the contents won't react with the containers. So we want to make sure that whatever is put inside the containers won't cause them to corrode or cause a chemical reaction. And I also want to note that the contents can't react with each other either. So whatever you put inside the container can't react with the other pharmaceuticals that are in the container. We also included a security requirement that containers have to remain closed and secured in a manner that prevents unauthorized access to contents. And that's because we want to do whatever we can to prevent illicit diversion, which is a nice way of saying that we want to make sure that they don't get stolen. There's also a one-year accumulation time limit from the date when accumulation began. In contrast, potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals don't really have very many standards. There's no labeling standards, no container standards, or accumulation time limits. The preamble describes in detail our rationale, but in a nutshell, we believe that there is sufficient financial incentive for healthcare facilities to manage them properly and ship them off-site in a timely manner. And there's also relatively low risk to human health and the environment. This slide highlights the differences between the standards for non-creditable versus potentially creditable. I'm not going to go through each line, but I just want to point out that the fourth line about individual hazardous waste determinations, that's not required for either non-creditable or potentially creditable if a healthcare facility chooses to manage all of their waste as hazardous. And then also, actually, the last line isn't included. We don't talk about that in the previous slide, so I'll just mention that hazardous waste pharmaceuticals are not required on the BR for both types. And here's the summary matrix that Kristen introduced. We're starting to fill that in. You're going to see it again, so I guess I won't really spend much time on it, and I will hand it back to Kristen to talk about VSQG healthcare facilities.
Okay. Thanks, Brian. So healthcare facilities that are VSQGs are not subject to Part 266, Subpart P, but because this is RCRA, there's always an exception to that, and that the exception here is the sewer ban. And we'll talk about the sewer ban a little bit later. So VSQG healthcare facilities can have a couple of choices. They can choose to either opt into Subpart P and comply with all its provisions if they want to do that, or they have some optional provisions in Subpart P that they can use without being considered, you know, actually opting into Subpart P. So there are four of those optional provisions, and we'll talk about each one very briefly. The first one is that a VSQG healthcare facility can continue to send its potentially critical hazardous waste pharmaceuticals to a reverse distributor in order to receive the manufacturer credit. The second optional provision for VSQGs is a variation of the new off-site consolidation provision under the 2016 Generator Improvements Rule. And this allows a VSQG healthcare facility to send its hazardous waste pharmaceuticals off-site to another facility, provided the receiving facility is either a healthcare facility operating under Subpart P and meeting certain conditions, or the receiving facility can be an LPG operating under the Generator Improvements Rule version of this off-site consolidation, meeting the conditions under that. So you have your choice as a VSQG, which kind of off-site consolidation provisions you want to comply with. You know, you might choose to do the Part 262 one if you have something other than pharmaceuticals that you are consolidating off-site. And then the next two optional provisions for VSQGs are specifically for long-term care facilities. So the first one is that a long-term care facility that is a VSQG that has an on-site collection receptacle can use that on-site collection receptacle to discard its hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. I'm not sure how many of these on-site collection receptacles at long-term care facilities actually exist yet. The way the DEA regulations are written, it's the retail pharmacy that has to install the collection receptacle at the long-term care facility. The long-term care facility can't do it itself, so I'm not sure how many of them are out there yet. But in the event that they are eventually placed in a long-term care facility, we figure that placement of the hazardous waste pharmaceuticals by the VSQG in those collection receptacles is preferable to the VSQG putting those pharmaceuticals into the municipal solid waste trash bins. The second one that's specifically designed for VSQG long-term care facilities is that a long-term care facility with 20 beds or fewer will now be presumed to be a VSQG and therefore not subject to Subpart P, except the sewer ban. So that's just kind of changing the burden on the long-term care facility. So long-term care facilities, you know, with more than 20 beds can also be VSQGs. They're going to have to continue to demonstrate that by tracking their monthly hazardous waste generation as they do now. But the long-term care facilities with 20 beds or fewer will no longer have to demonstrate that. Okay, so next I'm going to be talking about three sections of the rules that apply to both healthcare facilities and reverse distributors. You know, the way the regs are kind of set up, structured, or organized is that, you know, the healthcare facility standards come first and the reverse distributor standards come last, and then sandwiched in between are a series of regulations that apply to both healthcare facilities and reverse distributors. So first, you know, it's been mentioned several times already, but this rule finalizes the sewer prohibition that we propose, and that is that hazardous waste pharmaceuticals may no longer be sewered. Okay, so you can't put them down the drain, down the sink, down the toilet, you know, no flushing, however you want to say it, can no longer be sewered. So sewer prohibition is the one thing that applies to all healthcare facilities, regardless of generator category. So it applies to all healthcare facilities, including those that are VSQGs, including long-term care facilities, and it also applies to all reverse distributors. It also applies to all hazardous waste that are DEA-controlled substances. There's no exceptions for those, so including what DEA refers to as pharmaceutical wastage. That's a term of art that they use for things that, for example, are left over in syringes. They allow those to go down the drain, pharmaceutical wastage, DEA does, but we do not. So hazardous waste that are also DEA-controlled substances are subject to the sewer prohibition. And although the rule technically only applies to hazardous waste pharmaceuticals and only those managed at healthcare facilities and reverse distributors, we strongly discourage the sewering of any pharmaceuticals by any entity with very few exceptions. And remember, as Brian pointed out earlier, the sewer prohibition, although it's part of subpart P, the sewer prohibition, because it was a HSWA provision, will be effective in all states on August 21st, 2019. So in just a few months, it's going to be effective in all states, regardless of whether that state is authorized and regardless of whether the state has adopted subpart P, it will be effective. I think long-term care facilities and some of the smaller healthcare facilities really have to be aware of this and get on top of this by the summer. Okay. So the second provision that applies to both healthcare facilities and reverse distributors are two new conditional exemptions. So the first one is more general. It's for the handful of RCRA hazardous waste that are also DEA-controlled substances that until now have been subject to both RCRA and the DEA regulations. And the second one is more narrow and targeted, and it's to promote take-backs of pharmaceuticals. And that one is for household waste pharmaceuticals that are collected in these DEA-authorized collection receptacles, sometimes referred to as kiosks. You can find in hospitals and retail pharmacies. So, you know, under the DEA regulations, retail pharmacies and hospitals that are already DEA registrants can amend their DEA registration to become collectors of household pharmaceuticals. But the idea is that, you know, the DEA has their take-back days, you know, twice a year, but the more collectors that install these kiosks, the better we can kind of move to a more permanent take-back of household pharmaceuticals. So under the DEA regulations, once those household pharmaceuticals are collected, now they have to be destroyed to meet the non-retrievable standard. So here's, by the way, just the list of the handful of RCRA hazardous waste that are also DEA-controlled substances that we're aware of. So what do we mean by conditional exemption? So we mean that in both cases, the hazardous waste pharmaceuticals are exempt from RCRA, provided that they comply with certain conditions, and those conditions are related to the treatment and destruction methods that are allowed. So first of all, because of the sewer prohibition, they can't be sewered. Second of all, because we're essentially deferring to DEA regulations here and trying to eliminate duplicative regulations, they've got to comply. If they're not going to comply with RCRA, they have to comply with the DEA regulations. Third, they have the option of destroying the collected pharmaceuticals by a method that the DEA has publicly deemed in writing to meet their non-retrievable standard. But since DEA has not done this so far, chances are that they are going to be combusted. So we want to clarify what types of combustors are allowed. So they have to be combusted at one of the following types of permitted facilities. Right? And initially we proposed only large or small municipal waste combustors and hazardous waste combustors, but we expanded the list of combustors to maximize options, and we've now added HIMWEs and SISWEs to that list. And then finally, the third provision that applies to healthcare facilities and reverse distributors relates to empty containers. So the new empty container standards apply to, well, let me mention this. They're specifically developed for the types of containers that are found in healthcare facilities. This has been a particularly vexing area for lots of healthcare facilities, and we've heard about it for a long time as being a problem, and we were very motivated to address this issue in this final rule. So the new empty container standards apply to containers with hazardous waste pharmaceuticals that are both non-acute and acute. The ones with the acute pharmaceuticals were the ones that were particularly problematic for healthcare facilities. They also apply to healthcare facilities and reverse distributors that are subject to Subpart P, but they also apply to anybody else with containers of hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, because not only do we add provisions in Subpart P, but we also amend the existing empty container regs in 261.7. And as with 261.7, the residues remaining in, quote, RCRA empty containers are no longer regulated as hazardous waste. So this new empty container standard can be used to determine whether a healthcare facility is even subject to Subpart P. And it's possible that a small healthcare facility that's kind of on the bubble between being a VSQG and an SQG may remain a VSQG if it can use these new empty container standards to demonstrate that their containers are RCRA empty. So there's four different standards for the different types of containers found in a healthcare facility or healthcare setting, and we tried to make these new standards, you know, straightforward and easy to implement, and we'll go through each of those moving forward. But the big, and I think, welcome change to a lot of folks is that triple rinsing of containers with acute hazardous waste pharmaceuticals is no longer required in order to make those containers RCRA empty. So we'll go through these four types of containers one by one. Let's start with the stock bottles slash dispensing bottles that are either 1 liter or up to 10,000 pills, as well as the unit dose containers. And when we say unit dose containers, we're talking about, you know, individual packets or Dixie cups, maybe souffle cups, wrappers, blister packs. There's a new standard for these for both acute and non-acute hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. In order to make them RCRA empty, you simply have to remove the contents. Now you can remove, they can become RCRA empty by either dispensing the pharmaceutical in the container to a patient, or let's say, you know, you bring it to a patient, the patient refuses it, you can then empty the containers into a hazardous waste accumulation container. No rinsing, voila, package empty, throw it in the trash. The second type of container are syringes. And again, we've got a new standard here. The standard being that in order to be empty, you have to fully depress the plunger. That's, again, for both acute and non-acute hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. So, again, the syringe can become empty either by administering the contents to a patient or emptying, if maybe there's a little bit left over after you administer the patient, you can empty it, the remaining contents, into a hazardous waste accumulation container. But I want to make clear, crystal clear, you may not make that syringe empty by squirting the remaining contents down the sink, right, because of the sewer prohibition. If you've got remaining contents after administering it to a patient, those contents have to go in a hazardous waste accumulation container and not down the sink. So if it is, if that syringe is RCRA empty because you have fully depressed the plunger, then RCRA is not going to apply to that syringe anymore. Now, if it has a sharp attached to it, you might have other regulations that will apply to it, like medical waste regulations, and it has to go in a sharps container. But if it's RCRA empty, RCRA won't apply. If, for whatever reason, you can't fully depress the plunger and it's not RCRA empty, and you have to put it in a container that meets both RCRA regulations, and if it has a sharp attached to it, then sharp container slash medical waste regulations. Okay, let's talk about IV bags, the third type of container. Again, there's a new standard for these to render them RCRA empty, and it's, again, pretty straightforward. You have to fully administer the contents of the IV bags for it to be considered empty, whether it's non-acute or acute. Now, if it's non-acute, if you're unable to fully administer the contents, we do allow the old standard for non-acute hazardous waste pharmaceuticals for you to use the existing regs in 261.7 to demonstrate that it's empty. On the other hand, if it's an acute hazardous waste pharmaceutical and you're unable to fully administer the contents, then the IV bag is not RCRA empty and you must manage it as a non-creditable hazardous waste pharmaceutical. And finally, let's talk about the fourth type of container, you know, what we kind of is the catch-all, as we call other containers and delivery devices, and we include, you know, inhalers or nebulizers, tubes of creams or gels. In this case, there is not a new standard. What we're allowing folks to use the existing, for non-acute hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, we're allowing folks to use the existing standard that is in the existing empty container regs in 261.7. On the other hand, for acute hazardous waste pharmaceuticals in other containers, there is no new standard and there's no old standard either. There's no triple rinsing. These things cannot be considered RCRA empty. They must be managed as non-creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. It's very difficult to tell if a tube or inhaler is empty, and it's virtually impossible to triple rinse them. So they must be managed as hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. And let's turn it over to Brian.
Yeah, thanks, Kristen. So similar to the healthcare facility standards, the shipping standards are also divided up by the type of hazardous waste pharmaceutical that you're dealing with. For non-creditable and evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, and again, these are items that no longer have that potential value, they both have to be sent to a TSDF, directly to a TSDF for disposal. They both also have to be sent using the hazardous waste manifest and a hazardous waste transporter. For healthcare facilities that are shipping non-creditable pharmaceutical waste, they are not required to use all applicable waste codes on the manifest. Instead, they have to use this new waste code that we came up with for the rule, which is PHARMS, and that will go in item 13. Additional waste codes are allowed, but they're just not required. And I also want to let folks know that this new farms waste code will be pre-populated in eManifest. I've tried it out. You can use the search function to find it, and then you just select it, and that will be in place in time for the August 21st federal effective date. So RDs are a little different. RDs that ship evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceuticals to a TSDF, they do have to list all applicable waste codes on the manifest. So like the healthcare facility standards, there are relatively few shipping requirements for potentially creditable waste pharmaceuticals, and that's, again, because they have that potential value. So potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals can be sent to from a healthcare facility to a reverse distributor, even if they're ultimately destined for a TSDF. We are not requiring the use of a hazardous waste manifest or hazardous waste transporters. Common parcel carriers are okay to use. One of the only things that we're requiring is that the shipper has to receive delivery confirmation from the reverse distributor within 35 days from when the shipment was sent. Typically, the electronic tracking systems that common carriers offer will be sufficient to meet the standard as long as you can prove that the shipment was taken into the custody and control of the reverse distributor. And one of the common ways to do that is to require a delivery signature. We want to make sure that the packages aren't just left outside of a building unattended. And lastly, the facility that initiates the shipment has to keep records of the delivery confirmation for 3 years. So one of the main reasons why we wanted to finalize this delivery confirmation requirement is to make sure that shipments don't get lost or stolen in transit, and that was a big concern for many of the commenters on the proposed rule, and that's, again, because pharmaceutical waste is unique among hazardous waste because it has potential for illicit diversion. So there's the summary matrix again. We've added the shipping requirements, and the only thing that we have left to fill in are the reverse distributor standards, so I will hand it back to Laura.
Thanks, Bram. So as I mentioned earlier, we finalized tailored standards for reverse distributors, and we really tried to keep current business practices in mind when developing the final reverse distributor standards. Under the final rule, reverse distributors are considered a new type of hazardous waste management facility. that can accept potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. So they don't need a permit, but there are also no generator categories. They're all considered the same thing under Subpart B. The standards are very similar to the standards for large quantity generators, but with a few additions, such as inventory and security requirements. We finalized the maximum number of transfers between reverse distributors to prevent endless transfers of hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. The potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals can go to multiple reverse distributors, but if they're hazardous waste, they must ultimately go to a TSDF. As long as manufacturer's credit needs to be verified and the hazardous waste pharmaceuticals are destined for a reverse distributor, they are still considered potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. Because the potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals still have value before they are evaluated for credit, we're able to take a lighter regulatory touch for the potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. On the other hand, once manufacturer's credit has been verified, they are considered evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. And at this point, the value has been realized, so the regulations become more robust for the evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. We increased the accumulation times for reverse distributors in the final rule relative to what they were in the proposal. So once the reverse distributor receives the potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, they have to inventory and evaluate each one within 30 days to determine if it needs to go to another reverse distributor or to a TSDF. The 180-day accumulation time limit doesn't begin until after the reverse distributor evaluates the pharmaceuticals. So in total, they can accumulate the hazardous waste pharmaceuticals for 210 days. For potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals that are destined for another reverse distributor, there are no specific labeling or container standards, and they do not need to be included in the biannual report. As I mentioned, once they become evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, the more robust regulations kick in. For evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceuticals that are destined for TSDF, the reverse distributor needs to designate an on-site accumulation area and conduct weekly inspections of the accumulation area. For personnel handling evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, the training standards are the same as the large quantity generator training standards. These pharmaceuticals need to be labeled as hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, and the containers need to be in good condition. And hazardous waste codes are required prior to transportation off-site, and the reverse distributor needs to include them in their biannual report. And I'll note that the reason potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals do not need to be included on the reverse distributor's biannual report is because we do not want these pharmaceuticals to be double counted. They're going to another reverse distributor where they will become evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceuticals and need to be included on that next reverse distributor's biannual report. So here's the summary matrix for the reverse distributor standards that sums up what I discussed, which is that once the potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals are evaluated and become evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, the more robust LQG-like standards kick in. And just for your reference, here's another matrix that shows the accumulation times for reverse distributors. They have to evaluate the potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals in 30 days, and they can accumulate for another 180 days after evaluation. So we have finally filled out the entire summary matrix for subpart P, and I'm going to hand it back to Kristen to wrap up.
Okay, thanks for bearing with us. We're almost done. Just got a couple more slides. So mainly we just want to leave you with a reminder and circle back to the state authorization and state adoption stuff that we started out with. The final rule is out and it is published, but you must be patient. You cannot use it yet. It's not effective until August. The effective dates, however, will vary by state. And we will have maps on our website tracking the state adoption of both Subpart P as well as the nicotine exemption. But stay tuned, right? So just want to present the effective dates one more time in a slightly different format. So when it comes to the nicotine exemption, that's less stringent. So it's only effective federally in August in non-authorized states, territories, and Indian country. Authorized states have to adopt it, and it's not effective until the state adopts it, and since it's less stringent, states aren't required to adopt it. On the other hand, there's the more stringent aspects. The sewer ban is the HSWA provision, so that will be effective everywhere on August 21st, 2019. But as for the rest of Subpart P, which is also more stringent, it's only effective in non-authorized states on August 21st, meaning only Alaska and Iowa, territories in Indian country in August. Otherwise, you must wait for the state adoption for it to become effective. And if the state does not require a legislative session, they have to adopt it by July 1st, 2021. If they do require a legislative session, then they have to adopt it by July 1st, 2022. Now, we want to leave you with our contact information. Narendra is the guy you want to talk to if you've got questions about nicotine. Jessica Young is our branch chief, but I wouldn't email her just yet. She's still out on maternity leave. And I will note that we will be doing Q's and A's today, and we will undoubtedly get Q's and A's in our emails. But we can't always get to your answers immediately or individually, but we will use the questions that we don't get to today and the questions that we get in email that we're unable to get to, we'll use those to help us develop FAQs that we'll put on our website in the future. So we've gone a little bit over, about 3 minutes over than we normally go, but we will dedicate the rest of this to Q&A, and we're willing to stay a little bit extra if you guys can to answer questions.
Okay, great. Thanks. Hi, everyone. My name is Christine Akari, and I will be asking your questions to our presenters for today. So there's a little bit of confusion still with the generator category situation. So the question is, one of the slides indicates there are no generator categories under Subpart P, but then some of the slides mention the requirements for very small quantity generators. So could maybe just clarify that one more time.
Right. So VSQGs, by and large, are not subject to the rule, with the exception of the sewer ban. And then they have those optional provisions that they can take advantage of, but they're not required to. So a healthcare facility that is currently an SQG or an LQG would be subject to Subpart P. But once they're under Subpart P, then the generator categories really are not relevant when it comes to hazardous waste pharmaceuticals. So the VSQG is still relevant, but the SQG and the LQG is not relevant for hazardous waste pharmaceuticals because there are no generator categories under Subpart P. So that means the generator categories for SQG and LQG will only be relevant to non-pharmaceutical hazardous waste.
Okay, great. That's a little bit clearer. We have a question on where the training standards are located. If you guys could speak a little bit more to those. It looks like maybe they're in a couple different places in the regulations.
The training standards, I can't remember if we have training standards for potentially creditable healthcare facilities that manage potentially creditable, but for the healthcare facilities that manage non-creditable, they're in 266.502B. But there's nothing, like I said, there's nothing prescriptive in there. They're like the SQG 262 training standards. They just say that you have to be, you know, familiar with the waste, how to handle the waste that you generate and the emergency procedures.
And the training standards for reverse distributors are in 266.510C. And reverse distributor for reverse distributors, only the personnel handling the evaluated hazardous waste pharmaceuticals need to be trained in the proper handling, and their training standards are the same as the large quantity generator training standards.
Okay, great. Thank you both. Mm-hmm. Next question, When shipping potentially creditable prescription medications to a reverse distributor, is uniform hazardous waste management?
The buyer say, oh.
Did you hear the rest of the question?
I did. Yeah, there's no manifest required when shipping potentially creditable hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, either from a healthcare facility to a reverse distributor, or when shipping from a reverse distributor to a reverse distributor, is the manifest required?
No.
No. So in neither case.
Okay, great. I saw that on your chart, but just to clarify.
Right, so I just want to add that there is tracking required, but it's not in the form of a manifest, right? So there's tracking required and shipment confirmation has to go back to the shipper, to the person who originated the shipment, like a manifest. So there's tracking that very much mimics a manifest, but it's not with a hazardous waste transporter, so it's not a manifest.
Great. Thanks for that clarification. Under the new empty container rules, will cartridges or tanks for ENDS, which I now know means electronic nicotine delivery systems, be considered stock or unit dose containers, therefore residues in the container, those would be exempt under RCRA once they are used? It's a very long question.
So we've gotten this question before. We're in the process of developing an answer that will appear in our FAQs on our website.
We did get some questions in on different types of things and are they regulated. And one was, has the management of warfarin changed with the regulation? Warfarin's one of those.
Yeah, warfarin is a P-listed waste. Certain concentrations in most medical formulations are P001. No, nothing changes other than the empty container standards for warfarin. So, you know, most pharmacies, for example, will have stock or dispensing bottles that have had warfarin in them. They will no longer have to triple rinse them in order to make them empty. Although in practice, pharmacies typically don't triple rinse them to make them empty. They just manage the containers as acute hazardous waste with the residues in them. They won't have to do that anymore. As long as the pills are removed, the containers will be considered RCRA empty and they can dispose of them in the normal trash.
Okay, great. Thanks. Another question that I thought was very interesting. For facilities covered by 262 instead of 266, can waste pharmaceuticals be accumulated in satellite accumulation areas?
No, hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, the under subpart P under the healthcare facility standards and the reverse distributor standards, there are no satellite accumulation areas anymore. There's no central accumulation areas anymore. I guess there's nothing that prohibits you from putting it into a central accumulation area, but we purposely eliminated some of the language around satellite areas for healthcare facilities. You know, the at or near the point of generation thing was particularly troublesome. That's the language in the satellite regs that does not appear in subpart P because you can't necessarily install a satellite accumulation area in every hospital room, for example, and so you might have to go to the nurse's station, but that's not at or near the point of generation, and so we specifically eliminated that language.
Great, thanks for that clarification. Okay, we have a couple of more specific questions, and some vague questions. So I'm gonna ask this question, and hopefully it's the question this person is asking. I think someone wants us to revisit the definition of a pharmaceutical. If we could quickly just kind of look at that again and explain what we're talking about here in this rule as a pharmaceutical. And then we'll talk a little bit about, there's a couple of questions on, I think there's some confusion on controlled substances and how that differs.
Okay. I can just briefly turn to the slide on the definition of pharmaceutical and go over it again.
That'd be great.
Second.
Slide is that? I'm trying to bring it up.
It's slide 28.
Thank you. Almost there.
There's a lot of slides.
Good. There we go.
All right. So the definition of pharmaceutical is pretty broad. It includes all of the examples on the left-hand side of the slide and on the top of the right-hand side of the slide. So we use FDA's definition of drug to form our definition of pharmaceutical, but we went beyond that and wanted to include a lot of other waste streams that are commonly managed at healthcare facilities so they could have the benefits of managing all of these waste streams under the Subpart P standards. Because as Kristen mentioned, in order to operate under Subpart P, you have to be a healthcare facility and you have to be managing something that meets the definition of hazardous waste pharmaceutical, and of course a hazardous waste pharmaceutical has to first meet the definition of pharmaceutical. So we include things like dietary supplements, compounded drugs, PPE that's contaminated with pharmaceuticals, and we explicitly exclude the items on the bottom right-hand side of the slide from the definition of pharmaceutical. Was there more?
So I think there was something about DEA-controlled substances as well, right? So
yeah, what somebody asked, what guidance can you provide with respect to disposal of controlled substance disposal?
Well, controlled substances are regulated by the DEA, not by EPA. But there are a handful of hazardous waste pharmaceuticals that are also DEA-controlled substances, and that appears on a later slide. So we can only speak to the ones that are hazardous waste and not generally the other controlled substances.
Great, thanks. Another question about VSTGs. What do you have to do to prove the VSTG status? Is that we're back to 262? What you would have to do there?
Right, I mean, the current generator regulations the generator improvement rule redefined those categories, or I should say defined them for the first time and clarified those categories in the definitions for the first time. It talks about what you have to count towards your generator status and what you don't have to count towards your generator status. Doesn't ever really say exactly how one has to determine that as far as your records. So it's not new to this rule that one would have to determine whether you're a VSQG or not. So we did not address it, the mm-hmm. existing generator regulations.
Okay, great. Is there any sort of facility assessment required under these new requirements? That's not something I heard you guys cover in this training. It might be something else they're thinking of, but does that ring a bell for a facility assessment?
No.
Okay. One person's asking for clarification. They ask, will there be no accumulation weight limit for acutely hazardous waste after August 21st?
Oh, I think I know what they're, okay, sorry, I was a little confused, but I think they're referring to under the new generator improvements rule, the acute hazardous waste, we did the 1 kilogram, or excuse me, the 1 quart, or the 1 kilogram, and no. In the satellite accumulation area. No, we did not do that. That satellite accumulation is different than generator status, so it's 1 kilogram for acute hazardous waste to determine whether you're a VSQG. The 1 quart or the weight is under the SAA limits. I'm not entirely sure what the question was.
Okay, another question that came in. Do hazardous waste pharmaceutical areas require weekly inspections? Is there an inspection requirement?
No, there's no inspection requirements at a healthcare facility, and there's also no satellite accumulation area requirements. There are no satellite accumulation areas under Subpart P or central accumulation areas. So there would be, I guess, nothing really to inspect.
So there are inspection requirements that Laura mentioned for RD, though, for the accumulation area.
Okay, great. All right, I think we're at time and we're starting to lose people, so I'm going to hand it back to Jean to wrap up.
All right, thank you so very much. I'm going to walk through just a few quick reminders before we lose everybody for the day, and then we'll go ahead and close out today's live broadcast. So the very first thing I want to do is thank everybody for joining us for today's session. As noted earlier, there is already a recording available from the March 4th delivery online. So if you know of a colleague who would find this useful and they weren't able to join you today, please feel free to send them that link. We'll also send the information on how to access this in an email after today's live broadcast. I'll also remind everybody that copies of the presentation materials are already available to download from the seminar homepage. If you follow the related URLs window on the middle right of your screen, click the seminar resources link and press the browse to button, you'll be able to access the presentation content as well as other websites related to today's topic. There's also information for our presenters and organizers that you can use to reach out to them should you have additional questions later on. I will ask each of you to take just a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's live broadcast. Now, one of the most common questions we get is if we have certificates or CEUs for today's session. While we do not offer CEUs or PDHs, we will give you a participation certificate. You can actually download or print one of those out. In order to access that, you'll need to fill out our brief online feedback form. You'll find that again under the related URLs window on the middle right of your screen. Simply click the seminar feedback link and press the browse to button to open it up. Once you get to that form, fill it out completely, making sure that you check the box at the bottom, verifying you are here for the whole delivery, and make sure your email address is entered correctly on that form. As soon as you submit your feedback, you'll immediately have access to a certificate that you can either download or print and save for your own records. If you happen to join as a group from a location, such as a conference room, each person can actually follow the link to that seminar feedback form and fill out their own feedback form to get their own certificate, regardless of who registered for the event for the session. And so with that, I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. So I want to thank everybody who joined us for today's live broadcast. This will be the formal conclusion for today's session. Thanks so very much.